We're on the air.
It's the Q Report.
It's the Q Report. This is Mark Marbella. It's Sunday, and we have special guests sitting in.
Thank you.
Katie Kiefer.
Katie Kiefer.
If you haven't, I know you missed her in the first hour.
Yeah, well, you know, can't
have
everything.
We have her live today. Patrick is enjoying some time off for change down in Florida.
I know. What is he doing in Florida?
Because
it's
not hot
enough
in New York, apparently.
Yeah.
He has to go down into
Curtis
the Caribbean.
Curtis and I were just saying that. It's like, why would you go there? But, you know, whatever. Maybe he really enjoys that special lizard-like quality that only people who really love hot weather can have fun with. So, Mark, you have a great show lined up here.
We have a fantastic show.
Amazing. Packed with fabulous people.
We have, first, we're starting off with John Schwally, who is a filmmaker doing a historical documentary on FDR's secret Air Force, which is pretty interesting.
I don't think anybody knows anything about
that.
No,
it's a pretty amazing story, and he's going to screen it coming up in Cornell shortly.
Does this rival, like, Contra, Iran-Contra affair in terms of, like, having a secret army?
Except it actually protected the country. Almost exactly the same, though.
Ah.
I mean, it wasn't a scandal in the sense. I mean, the Air Force wasn't an Air Force at the time, of course. It was part of the Army, and so essentially the thrust of the film is that it was private investors, you know, Pan Am, et cetera, private planes who sort of helped. And, of course, back then there wasn't, you know, you have to sort of puddle jump across islands from, like, Gander, and they opened up Africa and certain airstrips. But we'll hear all about that.
I'm looking forward to it. Sounds great.
We also have, of course, most recently that hit New York State, the tomato blight.
That's right. We have Meg McGrath from Cornell University, who is a plant pathologist. She'll be joining us on the phone. And then we will have, hopefully, in studio, Michael Hurwitz with the Green Market Program in New York, who will talk about the impact of tomato and potato blight on the economics of farming in New York State. So I'm excited about hearing all about that.
Yeah, Michael said he's going to be here. And tomato blight is pretty scary.
It's a big deal. I mean, I'm sure many people saw the photographs in the Times of people who grow tomatoes, especially organic farmers who've been terribly hit by this and who have not much in the way of pathogens with which to fight the blight. And they've had to plow up entire acres of tomatoes. So it's definitely something we'll all be sharing concern with, especially when we can't buy those heirloom tomatoes in the farmer's market over the next few months, unless we want to mortgage our house and sell our children into slavery.
Well, Michael said, no problem. There's good tomatoes still for everybody, even though, and it may be related to the potato famine blight, actually.
We'll hear more about that from Meg.
And we're introducing a block, that's our doc block, and our topical segment. We're also introducing a reality estate this week about real estate, what is actually happening in the real estate renters market in New York.
Fascinating.
And hopefully we'll expand that. Of course, there's all kinds of little microcosms in New York City of what's happening that way. And we also have a writer on horses today.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. Being a track
enthusiast
myself, that should be great. Absolutely.
So great.
We're
going
to go to a break.
We're going to take a break right now and come back and 10 seconds, 15 seconds, and talk to John Schwally.
I'm a fool to care when you treat me this way. I know I love you, but what can I do? I'm a fool to care.
Okay, we're back with ears.
With ears, and I'm Katie Kiefer with Mark Marabella on the Q Report on Heritage Radio Network. We're sponsored today by White
Oak
Pastures. Cattle farm down in Georgia. Thank you, White Oak. And thanks to our engineer and producer for today, Jack Inslee and Nat Wiener.
Thanks, guys. We have with us our first guest, John Schwally. Are you there?
Hey, yeah, I'm here.
John, thank you for being here. You're calling in all the way from Long Island. We're actually on the same island. People don't know that. Brooklyn is part of Long Island.
Yes, people tend to forget there are four boroughs on Long Island.
Right, exactly. So, John, tell us about FDR Secret Air Force. How did you get started, and how did you find this topic? It's something that I don't think people have heard about before.
Yeah, well, for me, it was an easy topic to get started on. My father is retired from Pan Am, back in 2000. I mean, this for me has been going on for almost the better part of the last decade. I had found a book written by a former Pan Am mechanic manager, and he co-wrote it with a retired Air Force colonel who was based over in Cairo with the embassy. And it was about these airfields that the retired colonel, Tom Colbert, had come across while he was flying embassy staffers around the continent. And so I found it immensely interesting, and so I followed it up. I followed up with them, met with REG Davies, who at the time was the curator for civil aviation down at the Air and Space Museum, who was the publisher of their book, and we kind of went from there. Andy Dawson, who was the co-author, who was the retiree from Pan Am, he actually was above my father at Kennedy Airport years ago.
Were they alive at the time when this was going on?
Excuse me?
Were they alive at the time when this was going on?
Yeah.
Meaning the Secret Air Force, they were alive for it when, because Pan Am has a very storied history, obviously.
Yeah, well, Andy actually was a mechanic. I mean, he was one of the ones that was hired by Pan Am specifically to go to Africa to man this route for Pan Am and the U.S. and the British government.
So tell us how it came about. What was the need? What is the Secret Air Force exactly? And of course, there was no Air Force at the time. Technically, number one.
Right. Well, it was the Army Air Corps was just a fledgling organization back then. They didn't have a whole lot of airlift capability. They didn't have a whole lot of pilots, and they certainly didn't have long range capability and long range air crews that were experienced. So in the summer of 1940, the British were really getting knocked around between the Battle of Britain and with Rommel's Africa Corps in North Africa. They were really on the brink of getting knocked out of the Second World War, and
the Germans at that point were far advanced.
Yes. And at that point, the United States was kind of getting nervous. Hey, Europe is going to be totally overtaken. What are we going to do to defend the Western Hemisphere? And at that point, the Germans had all of North Africa. France had fallen in the spring of 1940, so all of the French colonies in Africa were more or less taken over by the Germans as well. So they were as far south as Dakar, which, if anybody knows their geography these days, it's basically as far west as you can get in on the African continent. And even back then, you could hop across from West Africa to the northeast corner of Brazil.
Includes Morocco, Algeria.
It's actually farther south than that. So if you followed it around, Algeria would be farther north, Morocco is farther west, and as you're kind of going around the horn there, you get down to Bathurst and Liberia and Senegal.
Right.
And so that's what they were worried about. They said they were figuring, if they can get to that jump-off point, they can certainly fly troops and equipment across to Brazil, and at that point use that as a beachhead towards taking over the Western Hemisphere.
What were the capabilities back then, of course, because... What were the capabilities? Because, of course, there weren't, Atlantic flights were still pretty risky ventures, even though people were doing it and had done it for several decades. But still, to move that many people in planes, what was the plan? How did they get the planes over there, and what was the plan to sort of counter that insurgence?
Well, the plan started as early as 1939, 1940. Once the war broke out in Europe, the Americans were thinking, all right, well, how are we going to defend ourselves? And at that early point in the Army War College, they were discussing different options. And one of the options was to build U.S. military bases all through Latin America and South America to help defend the hemisphere. And as the same as today, the Latin Americans didn't really trust us as far as they could throw us.
Past experience?
So, Yeah, exactly. You know, one of the Americans going to leave. That 100 years later, that right. hasn't changed.
Same question.
And so they really had a problem that they were grappling with. You know, how are we going to do this? And that's when they turned to Pan American. And I don't know how many of the listeners know that Pan American started out this is running airmail and freight out of Miami to Cuba and the Caribbean and Mexico and Latin and South America.
Hence the name.
Right, exactly.
Pan America.
And
so rather than create an Air Force from scratch, they kind of piggybacked on what was already going on in a private venture.
Yeah, exactly.
Did they have to retrofit the planes, or did they change the planes in any way in order to fulfill the requirements that they might have for this, for this secret Air Corps?
Well, it was.
And who funded
point,
this? If it was secret, so Congress didn't know about this. This was just FDR's little
right.
venture with the Pan Am businessmen kind
right.
of thing.
Right.
So there are certain parallels in American history with that, I would reckon, huh?
Yeah. Congress had passed this tremendous defense spending bill in mm-hmm. 1940. And out of that, FDR was given a special discretionary fund. I mean, today we'd just call it, money for black ops.
I thought it was going to be a slush fund, but okay.
Right. And so at that point, they said, all right, let's take some money out of here because then we don't have to worry about accountability.
Right.
And they signed a deal with Pan American to build out their facilities. And at that point, most of their facilities in the Caribbean and Latin America were seaplane bases
mm-hmm.
because these islands didn't have runways.
Yeah, right, of course.
And it was just at the right time in history where aviation was going away from the seaplanes onto longer-range land-based planes. So it wasn't such a stretch of the imagination for Pan Am to say, okay, it's time to start building up land facilities. So they took this money and built something like 25 bases throughout Mexico and the northern part of South America and through the Caribbean islands all the way down through Brazil. And so they used those airfields to hop aircraft down to Natal, which is the farthest northeastern corner of Brazil. And at that point, they would just take extra fuel tanks, put them in the cargo or passenger section of what we know now as DC-3s. There were C-47s. There were cargo planes. Mm-hmm. And used that extra fuel to make the hop across.
Where did they land? Was it Dakar?
They landed at first. They were using the Azores at
right.
initially,
right?
And from there they would fly into Liberia.
And of course, no radar, so it was a pretty easy, relatively easy as far as being detected. The
yeah.
Germans weren't going to be able to see. Radar wasn't invented yet.
Correct.
So what was the results, John? We have about a minute left. What were the results of the Air Force? Did it help? Did it what did it turn into the Air Force? I mean, what were the final? Did it turn back the Germans?
Yeah. Well, Pan Am was up and running in September of 1941, even before Pearl Harbor. So we were already supplying the British with ammunition and aircraft at that point. And from December of 1941 through December of 1942. Pan Am, and then later in 1942, the Air Transport Command under General Arnold slowly took it over to the point where by the end of 42, it was all Air Transport Command. But that route ended up ferrying over tens of thousands of aircraft to the front that would not have gotten there otherwise.
What did they do once they got there? Were they bombers? Were they taking troops? Were they dropping parachuters? Or what were they doing?
They were ferrying over ammunition. They were ferrying over B-17s, B-24s. They were ferrying over P-47s, fighters. Anything that needed to get over there, they were. And they were even using that route. They were ferrying over planes on aircraft carriers, and they would just fly them off onto the African continent, and then the Pan Am Air Ferries crews would fly them across into the different theaters of war.
Fascinating.
Were the pilots, they stay on to become military pilots, or...?
Some did, some didn't. They were offered commissions based on their experience. A lot of guys took them. A lot of guys stayed on with Pan American, and Pan American went on to get a bunch of different contracts to fly for the Navy throughout the different theaters of war across Africa to the Orient and to the Pacific as well.
That's fantastic. Well, John, tell us where people can give us a website or something where people can look. And I know you're still looking for funds, and you're going to be screening at Cornell. That's very exciting in front of an audience, an interested audience.
Yes. I'm very much looking forward to that. I'm crashing on getting all the last visuals in to lock this thing up.
You have incredible archival in that piece.
Yeah, there is. And the website is www.jfsfilms.com.
Mm-hmm.
Right on the front page, there's a graphic and a link to the trailer, which I just recently revised with David Hartman, who is narrating it, his track on it. So,
David Hartman of Good Morning America and many other...
Yes.
And original PBS, Good Morning America.
Right, and PBS's Walking Tours of New York.
Mm, yes, fantastic.
And the name of the film, again, is FDR's Secret Air Force.
Yes.
And you're expecting to start showing that in September, right?
I'm screening it up at Cornell to a conference that is re-evaluating Africa's role in World War II, so they're very interested in seeing it. So it's a fine cut for me to present to them, but once I have the finishing funds available, I can actually license all that footage to get it on the air.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's all colorful footage, beautiful. Well, John, thank you for being here. And,
yeah, it sounds really interesting, John. I look forward to seeing it myself.
Come back and tell us, you know, give us an update. And again, it's www.jfsfilms.com. And we'll be back with Michael Horowitz from Green Market and Meg McGrath from Cornell, out in Long Island also.
Yeah, that's right. Riverhead. Yeah. Thanks, John. Great. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
How deep is the ocean? How high is the sky? How many times a day do I think of you? How many roses are sprinkled with dew? How far would I travel to be where you are? How far is the journey from here to a star? And if I ever lost you.
Okay, we're back at the Q Report. It's Sunday, and therefore it must be the Q Report. I'm Mark Marabella.
I'm Katie Kiefer. This is the Heritage Radio Network. We're sponsored today by White
Oak Pastures. Katie Kiefer stepping in for...
I'm sitting in for Patrick Martins, yep.
This is great.
I know, it's fun. It's
welcome,
fun.
Katie, to
Thank
the Q.
Very
welcome,
much.
Welcome to 1 o'clock.
It's good to be here at the Q. Yeah, that's right. Since I didn't get to do the main course today, I got to get my radio fixed one way or the
that's
other,
right.
Mark. You just can't keep me away. So we have Michael Horowitz with us from the Green Market.
And Meg McGrath on the phone.
And Meg McGrath from Cornell.
We have a very interesting topic today. If people aren't aware, at least for our listeners in New York State, they may be aware, there was a terrible, what they call late blight in the tomato farms. And it's caused a big failure, and some of the organic farmers are struggling and wanted to hear more about it. And Michael and Meg, are you there? Thank you for joining us on the Q today.
Thanks for having us.
Great.
Absolutely. Good afternoon.
Hi, Meg.
So Meg, maybe you can start us off. Just tell us what the heck is a tomato blight and what happened exactly.
Late blight is a disease caused by a fungal-like organism. It's a disease that occurs regularly but fairly uncommonly, and this year it occurred uniquely, We've never had it this widespread, this early in the season. It's normally a potato disease, not a tomato disease. A lot of gardeners and also farmers were caught off guard because it's not a disease they're used to dealing with.
So I've read that it's similar. Is this true, similar to the Irish potato famine, is what happened in Ireland at that time?
It's not similar. It is that disease.
Wow.
It's the same pathogen.
That's amazing. So I saw on your site, you're out in Riverhead in Long Island as an adjunct to Cornell in out there in field studies. It's a pretty obvious disease, although you don't know you have it once it's in the plant. It looks like sort of a moldy. Describe it for those people out there who maybe have tomato plants and what it looks like.
And haven't figured out what's happened there.
Exactly.
Yet.
It produces large spots on the leaves, much larger than most of the other diseases we deal with. Large spots on the stems, on the fruit. Larger spots than you'll get with other kinds of diseases.
And Meg, isn't it true that people can go actually to the Cornell website, I think, to see photographs? Can you tell us what the link is to that website for the plant diagnostics? You have your Vegetable MD site there, I know.
Well, there's the Vegetable MD, and I've put a lot of, I started a photo gallery.
Yeah, I saw that.
And I've put a lot of information there. And if anyone Google searches late blight McGrath photo gallery, they'll turn up that site right near the top.
And that way you can look at your plants and decide whether or not this is what's happening. But I think if your plants have something wrong with them, you can pretty much assume that this is it. We got interested in this because Dan Barber actually picked this up in an editorial last week, talking about the reason why, and this is what I want to get into with you, is why did it come on so suddenly? Why is it so widespread? Let's talk a little bit about how those factors, had an impact on the tomato crop this year as opposed to other years where it's just kind of more of an isolated instance.
Well, that's it exactly. It started out uniquely. Typically, as I said before, it's a potato disease. It starts in potato crops. And that's because this is a pathogen that can't survive on dead plant tissue. We've got some other pathogens that can survive in our gardens, on our farms, because they can survive in that plant tissue for a year or two. Late blight pathogen cannot. What it can survive in that's living tissue is a potato tuber. So what can happen with a farmer is he may start off with a tuber that's got it in it, or he may have had it on his farm last year and some of the potatoes didn't get harvested, the tuber didn't die, a plant grows up from that leftover tuber, and he's got late blight.
Mm-hmm.
This year, it was found on plants in garden centers. And
yes, so let's talk
about
that.
Gardeners are not used to this disease, so they took the plants home, had no idea they had a problem, got it into areas of the Northeast that aren't used to having the disease.
Right, because the
normally
plants,
happens in the potato production areas.
Because the plants were from the South, as Dan Barber, by the way, is a chef upstate New York at Blue Hill.
And also
Blue Hill
in Manhattan.
Barns,
yeah.
And also
and
Manhattan. He pointed out that it's this great irony where the organic farmers, you know, who haven't, there's, Meg, talk about, there's basically three things that have to happen to sort of spread, just like in a human community or any sort of disease spreading, to make any disease sort of spread as rapidly as this one did. Can you talk about just those three things?
Well, to have any disease, the basic is that you've got to have a host, you've got to have the pathogen that causes the disease, and you've got to have the right environmental conditions.
And so
the first two are most important. If you don't have the disease-causing organism and you don't have a plant that's susceptible, you're not going to have disease.
So
you've got really favorable conditions like this year with all the rain and cloudy weather, cool temperatures, late blight can really take off. But I've still seen it start. In 2002, we first saw symptoms about right now when it was starting. It was good, hot, typical August. And the disease started here on Long Island.
Well, didn't it start earlier this year than ever before?
Well, June was very wet this year.
And July,
It was very wet. It was cool.
I know that my one tomato plant, is still got very green fruit.
It's interesting
on it, so.
That's what the editorial talked about, and Michael's here also from Green Market. I wanted to can join in. The editorial points out the sort of conundrum about that everybody's getting into gardening, and obviously Michelle Obama, etc. More gardens this year were planted, and that there was therefore more plants. And if the disease plants
and people were buying those plants from plant centers instead of starting their plants from seed, and I think that one of the points that Dan made, and I think probably also on your website, is that if you start the plants from seed yourself, then you're less likely to you know, experience this kind of rapid spread of a pathogen. I'm also curious about how it spread from potato to tomato, but that's another question.
Let's say one thing about how people purchase their plants, the gardener, the home gardener. They also could have gone to one of our farmers and purchased a tomato start from our farmer, who was educated and knows what to look for and knows how to grow the plant and could advise for care of that plant. When you buy it from the big box store, and this is really how it spread.
Yeah, like Home
Depot.
There's
nowhere on the ground there that's working there that's able to recognize the early signs. So they may have seen big blotches on leaves and never did anything about it because they didn't know what it was. And that's the same thing about green market in general. When you go and shop from the farmer who's there, who grew it and who can educate you about it, it's a different experience.
Talk about green market for those people who don't know, listeners who don't know.
So green market is a program of the Council on the Environment of New York City. We are an independent nonprofit. We have a relationship with the mayor's office, but we are an independent nonprofit agency. We operate 49 farmers markets throughout the five boroughs. We're a producer-only market, which means you have to grow it to sell it. We have a weird region, 250 miles to the north, 120 to the south, and 170 east and west. So if you're standing in Poughkeepsie, you're in the epicenter of it all. But really, our mission is to keep small farms viable and to make sure that New Yorkers have ready, available access to local agriculture and to help build a sustainable food system.
So have you seen any effect of this blight? I mean, what's happening? Is it, you know, for people out there who don't know, is it dangerous? Are the products limited now? What's happening?
Are they more expensive?
Are they more expensive? Exactly. What are the effects?
Lots to answer. We have seen a significant impact, and predominantly with our certified naturally grown and our organic growers. Folks who do use fungicides are not experiencing as much loss to the late blight as the other farmers are. And some have had their entire field crop destroyed by the disease.
And then what do they have to do? Don't they have to, like, take all of that plant matter out of the soil? Because
not only that, they then have to make sure that it's they can't put it in their compost pile. And
right.
Please correct me. I don't know the best science.
How should people get rid of plants?
Folks have incinerated, burned, they've taken it to places off-farm to make sure that it won't continue to spread.
The major concern is potato tubers, that people won't destroy those properly. This can be, if it's composted correctly, that is a fine way to get rid of it. A lot of our concern when we were telling homeowners to just get rid of the plants is that they would just dump it on top of their compost pile.
Mm-hmm, right.
The plants would sit there and there'd still be spores moving off of those plants for a while. I know my own compost pile. I just dump plant material on it. I'm not properly composting. But if properly composted is a fine way to get rid of the plants.
And what does that entail, properly composting? Like burying it under more soil, or how does that work?
You'd want to get this plant tissue buried. Another approach you could take would be to put it on the compost pile and then cover it with a tarp.
Uh-huh.
So it heats up underneath, you know, so it's contained and it's going to heat up underneath,
so
and the plant tissue is going to cook.
But aren't tubers underground anyway? I mean, what is the distinction you're making?
If a tuber heats up, you will kill it.
Okay.
A proper compost pile is going to get up higher than what the pathogen can stand.
Yeah, because compost gets pretty hot. I don't know if you've ever had a compost.
Yeah, it does. I mean, just even without the tarp. But
yeah.
I mean, meaning you can't leave it in your ground. But we're talking about tomatoes here. Burying them is an option or is not an option?
That's an option. Once the plant tissue is dead, the pathogen is dead.
And how close do plants have to be to each other to be contagious? Like, what's the general area?
What's the range of the spores?
Depends.
How far can they be blown?
They can go long distances. Mm-hmm. When we had it here on Long Island, and I'm way out. I'm out where the island forks.
Right.
And when it occurred in 2007, the nearest known place that had reported late blight was Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
Wow.
So Michael,
you can have those kind of jumps. You get a day where it's cloudy, overcast. The spores can get up in the wind currents. They're not exposed to UV radiation that would kill them in a couple hours. They can move in those air currents, get a rainstorm, they're washed down, and voila, you got disease.
Now, one of your earlier questions I want to get back to is, there are plenty of tomatoes in the market, and potatoes also. There are some farmers who had to rip up their entire potato crop this year. There are plenty of tomatoes in the market.
And it's not dangerous to humans, by the way. We should make that point.
Sure. And in terms of prices, just like all of our other products, it ranges. I've seen some of the cheapest heirlooms this year, actually. Mm-hmm. And
really?
Yep.
And that's encouraging.
And there are organic tomatoes that were raised in high tunnels, hoop houses, that are at market. So we still have a full range of tomatoes at market, from the affordable to the most expensive.
And what would you say to people? So it's not really harming the market in such a way.
No, but it's harming there are some individual farmers who are going to take a serious hit this year.
This is an interesting thing. What would you say? You know, it's been talked about everywhere that it's a really good thing to plant, and you know, we should all grow our own vegetables. And here's the sort of the dark side of it. How would you address that? Wow. You know, and as you said already, the organic people are the ones being hurt, and okay, there's the issue of the being sprayed with some sort of copper fungicide. But you guys can both jump in, either Michael or Meg. Go ahead.
I think this is a great learning experience for people to realize that whether they're gardeners or farmers, it's not always so easy to grow things.
Right.
Very rewarding, but not always so easy. And you can have something this devastating come along and realize just what our farmers go through every year.
Yeah.
It's a real challenge. Step back and realize what a pathogen can do. It's pretty... can be pretty destructive pretty fast.
I couldn't say that any better. And I think just like any endeavor that someone's going to get into, there's a learn. Don't go into things blindly. Educate yourself about how to do it, the best ways to do it. You can make educated decisions after you know what the options are. But that's exactly right. This is a learning opportunity, and it's also a way for people at our markets. The farmers are there, and it's a great opportunity to go talk to a farmer, ask them what it is, what's happening, and to learn about the daily rigors of being a farmer. If it's flooding one year and drought another year and a disease one year, I mean, this is the reality of agriculture.
So just to put a finer point on it, I mean, if I'm going to my, you know, and people go to their Home Depot, they're going to go to their Walmart, it's going to happen. If I buy two plants, one plant, 16 plants, I mean, if I plant an acre, I plant a little square in my backyard. What is the sort of danger for people out there? What, you know, for the amount that sort of could, or if they're fine plants and they could also likewise be diseased, as you were talking about, Meg, where, you know, by spores in the air. What's sort of the thumbnail of what the local farmer or the backyard farmer can do?
Do as far as controlling this?
Controlling it or being dangerous to it, meaning contributing to it.
Well, that is certainly was the issue this year, is that you've got a disease where the pathogen produces an easily dispersible spore. Therefore, we as gardeners are very much tied to farmers in that if we have a disease problem, we can give it to them.
Mm-hmm.
And having that tie, it can go in the opposite direction as well. But that's what caught us off guard this year, is it started where we didn't expect it.
I see.
Completely disrupted our normal chain of how we work with farmers to be able to control this disease.
I have one more question for you, Meg and Michael, and that is, big box stores are going to continue to sell plants in the future. What, how responsible are they going to be in the future in terms of having somebody on staff or a supplier who supplies these plants for the stores that people are buying? And then, you know, will they be educating their staff better, do you think? Or do you think this is something that could happen over and over again, regardless of how careful farmers might be? Because it really did seem to start with sort of the Home Depot style. I mean, not to vilify them or the people who were planting them, but, you know, it did seem to start with that kind of industrial farming or the industrial production of these plants for retail sale. And
From a region and to another region, yeah, it's the same as importing a tomato.
And how much responsibility are those big box entities going to take for this kind of spreading of disease?
It's an interesting question.
I mean, how can you make them not do it again, I guess, is my question.
Unless there's some type of consequence for their behavior,
for them,
it's not going to change. And I mean, and what we're seeing now, and going back to the last question about what can the gardener do, and going to this, know your source. I never stopped eating spinach when there was bacterial.
That's a great example, actually. Yeah,
but I knew where my food was coming from,
right?
And when there is an anonymous food system, and where you're going and having a conversation with someone who doesn't know the product, there will always be a risk for this. And again, if there are no consequences to these stores, I mean, our farmers who are getting hit by this, there's no insurance for their specialty
and
crops.
They've lost thousands and thousands of dollars.
If those burned in Home Depot, they'd be covered by insurance.
Right.
Unless their stores are made to have a consequence for their behavior, I'm sure they're not losing sleep over this the way we are.
Right.
I think there's one thing we have to look at in the whole distribution system and understand, which I didn't know until we got into this, and that's how these plants are being marketed. So it's not actually these stores, because they don't own the plants. And in a way, that to me made a lot of sense for how they market it, because they have someone who's an expert on growing, who's producing the plants and taking care of the plants, and you don't have people in these stores who are selling tons of other things also responsible for plants that they're not knowledgeable about.
Where are they sourced?
But it also means the stores aren't paying any attention to them.
Where are they sourced?
They are owned. The Home Depot that I talked to said they deal with 12 different companies, and they were local companies. I know some of our greenhouses, we've got some very large greenhouse operations here on Long Island. Some of those were producing plants for them, as well as some of these big major chains. And those companies completely take care of the plants. They bring them in, they water them, they come back several times a week, take away the bad ones, put in new ones.
So why were they so slow to recognize, the blight, since it's so obvious to somebody who knows something about plants? When you see a big black spot on one of your plants, you think, that can't be good.
It looks like mold for those who are...
Yeah, I mean, why wasn't it addressed more rapidly, I guess, is my point. I mean, it seemed to sort of be, happening. I think it was even on your website that I saw that it was like June 26th was when they first started identifying this, right? And,
A little before then, but right around then, yep.
That's very early. Are we out of it? Is it over? Are there long-term consequences? Is it a larger picture of we're going to be rainier because our climate is changing? What's the final word? We have about 30 seconds.
I think the major impact for next year will be if affected tubers aren't taken care of. And that's an important message for homeowners. If they just toss out their tubers into a compost heap and they're not properly disposed of, this will all happen all over
again. Okay, everybody.
New source.
That's the alarm. Bury the spuds. Bury your moldy spuds. That's the final word. Meg, we appreciate it. Thank you so much
for
joining us.
Meg, you are great. Thank you very much.
Michael Hurwitz.
You are welcome.
I know you're coming from Fox. You're going to Fox?
Coming from Fox. It's nice little change of venue.
Roberta's is much nicer. Well, thank you both for being here. And if it should raise its ugly head again, or there's more to it, we'll have you back.
Thank you so much for having us.
In the meantime, support the green markets and read Meg McGrath's blog.
And talk to your farmers. The other main headline is
Michael. Know where your food comes from.
And we're coming back in a little bit with our new reality estate, New York City Renters. What do they do? Those circles of blue. Why do they seem to picture a dream of love? Why do they fade my phantom parade of love? Puff. Marabella, and we have Katie Kiefer
sitting in for Patrick Martin.
Sitting in for Patrick Martin.
Enjoying a nice, hot, sweaty weekend in the Florida Keys.
As opposed to a hot, sweaty weekend in the...
In, in the New York Borough area.
In Heritage Radio Network studios.
That's right.
We love it that way.
Yeah. It's nice and warm in here today, right, Mark?
It's gorgeous.
It's just beautiful.
All we need is to put a little more steam on the rocks, and I'm really getting a good sweat.
Me too. Let's mention today that we are sponsored by White Oaks? What is wrong with me? I'm like losing. White Oak Pastures.
White Oak Pastures.
White Oak Pastures in Georgia. Thank you very much.
In Georgia.
And we're engineered today by Jack Inslee and
Nat Wiener.
Nat Wiener.
Thanks, guys.
And we're welcoming a new guest on the phone today.
And a new block.
And a new block. A
reality,
new segment.
Reality Estate.
Now that when Patrick's away, Mark just like, absolutely, he gets all organized here.
Absolutely.
See why he's a documentarian.
Yes. Everybody is very interested. Of course, New York's city has a really interesting rental market, and everybody's talking about real estate and the business downturn, and let's hear what is out there from a person who actually works in it. Alisa, are you there? Alisa Maresca, you're in Santa Cruz today.
I am in Santa Cruz, and I have to say, it's not quite as steamy out here as it is over there.
It's a much nicer place than probably going to the Keys in Florida, but thank you for being with us today and are introducing our new, being the first guest of our new Reality Estate block. So, Alisa, I know you do many things, and we've known each other for a long time, but one of your of the many things you do, you're a real estate agent. So tell us about what's going on. I know you work mostly in the rental market. Tell us what's happened, what's changed in the market since you've been working in it?
Well, you know, I haven't been in that long, but long enough to see what's really changed probably over the past 8-9 months, you know, since the market has really softened quite a bit. And what I've seen is probably what you guys are already suspecting, is that it's really, really soft, and it's kind of a renter's market right now, and people are spending a lot more time looking for places. They think, justifiably so, that there are better deals to be had out there. And it's changed a little bit of the way that we deal with the customers, because people aren't moving as much. People aren't coming to New York as much because there aren't as many jobs. So that's been a little interesting.
So, Alisa, you are a New York City resident, born and raised in Brooklyn. You've seen a lot. You actually own property yourself, and you manage many, or at least of your things in Brooklyn. And so tell us, I know you're focused on specific market in New York City, because, of course, there's all little microcosms in New York because it's so big and there's so many things going on in different neighborhoods, just to give people a lay of the land who aren't from New York. Tell us where you specifically focus for your renters.
Well, right. Well, sort of the thrust for the it's a very small, I guess you could call it a boutique company that I work for. We are focusing on small markets, and one of them is
In Focus, as it turns out. In Focus. I didn't mention that. I'm sorry. In Focus for the ladies over there.
Yes. And that's only been, they've been around for about a year and a half, 2 years. It was opened by two people who'd been in real estate for a while and decided they were tired of sharing their money with other people, so they started their own firm. And so there's a small staff of people that work in a focused area, and one of them is Roosevelt Island. And I have the idea being that rather than being someone that kind of runs around to all the different neighborhoods, which, you know, is done as well, we would sort of focus on a few and know them really well and really be able to, help people to understand what goes on and what it's like. And, and for our side, it cuts down on a lot of, running around.
So compared to other neighborhoods in Manhattan, is Roosevelt Island like the New Deal? Is it like a really good deal to move out to Roosevelt Island? And if you do, is there any place to go shopping? I'm actually planning on making a field trip out there because I have never lived in New York for 30 years, never been out there.
It's really, even for New Yorkers, we were talking about this earlier, Lisa, as we often do, Roosevelt Island is this really mystical, interesting place.
Totally. I think of it as sort of a 1984 kind of place with with high-rise, grim high-rises and no services and the strange little tram that you take to get out there. I mean,
it's really beautiful, actually, having been there. But talk about Roosevelt Island a little bit, Alisa, just to give people a background on what's there.
Well, it started way back in the day. It was just a farm, and they still have the original farmhouse on the island. Then they had the smallpox hospital, which is something that everybody, it's a ruin now, but everyone seems to know about that, and that's sort of on the southern tip of the island.
Sort of like turn of the century, right? Like 1919s or something?
Yeah, right. Yeah, in the late teens, I think. You know, don't.
Is that
don't,
where Typhoid
you know.
Mary was housed for
yes,
a while? Yes,
exactly.
I've
exactly.
seen footage of that, yeah.
Right, and there was also a hospital for the insane, which is what they called it, and that's now a luxury high-rise apartment building.
I love New York for that. It's like, you know, if it ain't being used, it's going to be used for something else.
Yeah.
Does it have beautiful architectural features? Is that why it was so pretty that they couldn't bring themselves to tear it down and build something ugly?
Yeah, they actually restored it. There's an octagonal building, and it had a spiral staircase that went all the way up, I guess, to the top of all the wards of the hospital, and they preserved that structure and built, like, two wings off of it, which cool. are the apartments, and the middle part is sort of like the main general lobby area, and, you know, I guess it is kind of cool that was preserved, and, you know, Nellie Bly... Mm-hmm. The reporter actually did a little expose, and she had herself committed and wrote some stories about what it was like
so Lisa,
to be in a
for yeah. For New Yorkers, how do we get to the island? We can get there by the tram or by the F train, right? Those are the two options. Is there a ferry at all?
There is no ferry. There's lots of talk about a ferry, a commuter ferry being put in somewhere, actually down by that building I was just talking about, but that hasn't happened just yet. You know, the tides, the currents are really strong
yeah,
around
are.
The island.
They are, actually, yeah.
So the logistics of that are a little complicated, I think. But
how many people live on the island? Is it a little self-contained community? It kind of, I mean, for those who don't know, it's in the East River, about... How far would you say from Manhattan, which is also an island?
Well, it is part. It's actually technically part of Manhattan.
Right.
So it's a 212 area code. It's not. It's a stone's throw. I mean, anyone who's seen the tram, that's how far it is. You do have a lot of people who live there that are diplomats because its proximity to the UN is so close that it's an easy commute for them. So. You do see a lot of people from all over the place. There are people who've been there for many, many years, you know, when they first really started having people live in the high-rises. Those are the ones that are a little closer to the subway and the tram, and then they started building north, and there are more buildings as you get further along. There's a rehab hospital on the island, so you will see a lot of people in wheelchairs and you know, people who are physically disabled. Mm-hmm. Because it's very easy to get around.
Yeah.
There's one street that goes through the whole island, and all the buildings have elevators, so everything is pretty accessible.
Are there cars?
So, yes, yep. There's a Roosevelt Island Bridge, and that sort of leads you right over into Long Island City,
uh-huh.
the Long Island City Astoria area, and it's literally a minute from that bridge to the 59th Street Bridge.
So we have about 30 seconds, Elisa. Tell us, what's the general range of what people can expect to find there for the renters who think York is just too close for them?
Well, I mean, there's a range of types of buildings there. There's extreme luxury, which, you know, can be a little bit more pricey, but still, I think, less expensive than living in the city. And then there are ones that are a little bit lower priced and, you know, I wouldn't say the quality deteriorates, but it's just not as fancy. There's no doorman. There's no someone there to open the door to take your packages and things like that. It's just pretty much an apartment. And a lot of these apartments have beautiful views. I mean, people, you know, if you're looking for views and green space and being really close to Manhattan, you know, you're almost better being slightly away from the main island and looking at it. And it's really quite lovely.
It has beautiful views, actually.
Yep. It really does.
What does it cost for a one-bedroom out there?
Well, I guess it depends.
In a sort
of
medium-level business. Yeah, in a moderate income-level building. You know, pretty nice,
what I'm
but
seeing
not fancy.
In this market, right now, I would say about $1,500 to anywhere upwards of $2,500. You can get a one-bedroom.
Very competitive. That's very competitive.
Yeah, I was going to say, how is that different from many other parts of Manhattan? I mean, you were saying earlier the market was soft, and I would think Manhattan landlords are probably begging right now. So
that's pretty low. Are there any Manhattan places for $1,500 a one bedroom?
That's so low. I live in a two bedroom for $1,100, so I don't know.
Well, you know,
that's called rent stabilization.
That's unusual.
Yeah, it's very unusual.
That's called being a Manhattan resident for 30 years
yeah,
in one place.
And that's amazing, actually. But I mean, $1,500 for one bedroom in Manhattan, I don't think it exists, does it, Lisa? Anywhere else?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, I'm sure it's out there. I mean, I'm sure, you know, if you're really out there scouring, you might find something. I'm going to say probably not the quality and the size of these apartments. They're actually a bit larger than what we're seeing on I guess I'll call the mainland. So you could get right now for $1,579, there are apartments in a doorman building with, you know, with a concierge and a gym and all of that stuff for $1,579. And they're very large.
That's unbelievable.
That's sweet.
Well, Lisa, we're out of time, but we hope to have you back. And thank you so much for our inaugural reality estate. I mean, maybe we'll change the name. We don't know. That's we're coming up with Matt Haggerty next.
Talking track.
Yeah, talking horses.
It's a lonesome old town when you're not around. I'm lonely as I can be.
At the Q Report for our last segment. I'm Mark Marabella.
I'm Katie Kiefer. This is the Heritage Radio Network, and we're sponsored today by White Oaks Pasture in Georgia.
We thank them very much.
We thank them very much and hope that many more sign up to sponsor our programs.
And speaking of pastures, from Kentucky, visiting today in New York.
Down from Saratoga Springs at the height of the racing season.
We have Matt Haggerty, a journalist and writer.
Thanks for having me.
So Matt, tell us why you're up. I know you've been covering the horses for a long time. You've been writing about the horses. What's happening in Saratoga?
Well, Saratoga is kind of the summer place to be for horse racing. There's a 6-week race meet up there that is kind of the East Coast center of horse racing, if there can be an East Coast center. On the West Coast, they race at Del Mar at the same time. So you have the best horses in the country basically split between those two coasts. The best horses on the East Coast typically go up to Saratoga for the summer. The best horses on the West gather in Del Mar, and that's where you're going to find the best racing in August and actually for probably some of the best racing of the year.
So is, for instance, Rachel Alexander racing this season up at Saratoga since
the,
she was...
The filly, those who aren't acclimated to the racing...
we all know Rachel Alexander.
The filly.
Everyone knows Rachel Alexander. She is based, she is training up in Saratoga right now, but we don't know...
She was the Derby winner.
She won the Preakness.
She
won the Oaks, and then she came back and beat the boys in the Preakness.
And how often does that happen? Because the Preakness is a very long track.
Yeah, it's very rare for that to happen because in most cases it's rare for fillies to race against the boys. They do have their own restricted races that they can race in where they don't have to run against males. But every once in a while, you do have sporting owners who want to really test the really good fillies. And right now, she is. Without a doubt, having beaten the boys twice, she raced at the Haskell a couple weekends ago down at Monmouth Park and beat the boys again. She is without a doubt the dominant 3-year-old in the country, and that's males or females. She's probably the most impressive filly we've seen in 2 decades. That goes back probably to Ruffian.
Uh-huh. There was a little bit of a controversy, but with the jockeys after the Preakness at the Derby.
Well, the jockey changed,
right.
He switched over to another horse.
Yeah, you've never
but
seen.
From
this
the same
before.
Trainer, right?
Yeah, no, different trainers, but the jockey had to make the choice. He had only ridden, this is Calvin Burrell. He had only ridden Mind That Bird one time, and ran him to a victory in the Kentucky Derby.
That's right.
He had ridden Rachel in all of her races, including just a blowout win the day before the Derby in the Kentucky Oaks, as visually impressive a performance as you've ever seen. And he knew that he was going to ride. He was going to ride Rachel Alexander for the rest of the year. Owners don't take kindly to the fact if their regular jockey takes off a mount. So he had to choose, okay, do I ride the Derby winner or do I ride Rachel and keep that mount for the rest of the year? knowing that I'm probably going to win absolutely every race. Anytime I get on her back, I'm going to win that race. So he did the right thing, you know, by choosing Rachel, and that's borne out by the fact that Rachel beat
my
Netbird when
races.
She wasn't at her best in the Preakness. She's back to her best now, and now we have to figure out if she's going to race against Zenyatta, which is the forgotten filly in all this thing.
What's her name?
Zenyatta. Zenyatta is based on the West Coast. She just won her 12th
race. We haven't heard about her over here on the East
Coast.
Rachel Alexander
ran in the Triple Crown, which is where the general public watches all the races. In the background of this, we've been watching another Uber filly called Zenyatta, who is 12 for 12. She races almost exclusively.
That's amazing.
She has not lost a race. And so everyone in the racing industry wants to see this matchup. It doesn't look like it's going to happen, and that's unfortunate because maybe the rest of the regular racing public would, or regular general public would, pay a little more attention to racing if they knew about how, you know,
how exciting
this could be.
Would
we
be,
have an undefeated filly in Zenyatta who has a completely different racing style. She doesn't dominate her races, but she wins absolutely every time. And we have Rachel who just runs almost
she blows
like an accelerating
out,
machine.
Right.
So it would be really fun to see that matchup, but it just doesn't look like it's going to happen, at least not this year. So.
Matt, let's ask you a question to go back a little bit. What do you mean when you're talking about racing styles? And let's also talk for a second about the importance of a jockey, like how much a jockey has an impact on how a horse races and what their job is. I think people tend to think that jocks get up on the back of the horse and the horse just blows through the crowd and it either wins or it doesn't. But the jockey has a lot to do with the chemistry of how a horse, you know, gets to the finish line.
Yeah.
Let's describe that a little bit.
Yeah, there are a couple
schools.
There are a couple schools of thought on that. You know, the best jockeys in the world are the ones in which the horse doesn't notice that the jockey is on their back. That's an art. That's something that's developed, you know, over years and
so
years.
So who has
riding.
That? Who are some of the great jockeys?
Jerry Bailey, you know, who retired, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, was probably the best I'd seen at it. The idea that he was going to let the horse do what the horse does best. In the case of, say, Rachel Alexandra, the best thing she does is get out towards the front and really run her opponents into the ground. But the problem is you can't let a horse, especially since the horse doesn't really know the distance you're going, the final distance, you can't let her or him just kind of, you know, go as fast as he or she wants in the early stages of the race and have nothing left. So the jockey's job in a case like that is to kind of conserve her power, conserve her strength, you know, keep her going at a measured pace. And
so she's still having, or he or she is still having fun running the race because horses like to win.
Oh,
right?
They are
very competitive, and I think that's something that is lost on a lot of people who don't watch horse racing a lot. But these animals really enjoy running. I mean, they do get off on it. They're trained to do it. They spend a lot of time working. They're working animals. They are not pets. So I think, you know, the racing industry gets a bad rap a little bit, I think, especially with thoroughbred racing, because you know, sometimes things happen, but the fact is, like any other athlete, they get injured, but they really love their sport. And the whole idea that a jockey has to exert some control over the effort that they put out and how they thread through the pack. Like, was it, I forget whether it was the Derby or which one had the really packed field.
That was the Derby.
The Derby was like
the ride by Calvin Burrell was
like 20 horses.
It was incredible.
Every gate was filled. I mean, it was huge, huge run. So, how does a horse learn how to thread through and stay on the rail versus running on the outside where you have a bigger track to run? And
well, that's where the jockey comes in.
That's where the jockey does come in, and that's why Calvin Burrell is so respected. And his nickname is Bo Rail in Kentucky because he'll always go to the rail, which a lot of jockeys are afraid to do that. They get in tight quarters down there.
Yeah, it's scary.
But it does help the horse. You mentioned the horse's competitive instincts. And if you put two horses in a field, they will eventually race each other. They will eventually try and find out which one's faster. And if you put a horse in tight quarters like that, the last thing he did was go between the rail and a horse that was literally drifting towards the rail, a hole no other jockey would go for. That horse wants to get through that
Absolutely.
Spot as quickly as the jockey wants that horse to go through. So that actually helps that horse in that instance. And if you watch Calvin's best rides, including Street Sense, he won a Derby on Street Sense, you know, 2 years ago with this similar type of ride. You see a guy who's a tactician who's making decisions just on the fly in a very, you know, dangerous environment, and that takes bravery. I guess I'll just say bravery.
Oh, I think, I mean, jockeys are amazing. I mean, for nobody who's ever been to the, if somebody has never been to the track and actually seen jockeys, they are diminutive men who are so whip strong. I mean, every little muscle is just twingling. I mean, you can really see it. And they are standing, when they're riding that horse, they are resting on the balls of their feet on a little strip of iron, and no other part of their body is touching an animal that is going how fast?
You're topping out at around 37 miles an hour.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And, enough said. You know, and surrounded by 1,500-pound animals who are going to crush you if you fall off.
And they do. I mean, Shoemaker was famously the voted the greatest athlete, whatever decade that was, or was that 90s or 80s?
Yeah.
I mean, for the amount of wins he had, and for the amount of different horses he rode.
The saying is that pound per pound jockeys are the strongest athletes in the world.
As they say. I wanted to, Matt, we talked about earlier, I wanted to talk about sort of the end phase of racing. This is an agricultural sport. You're from a state famously for raising horses, Kentucky, or you currently live in that state. Tell us about what happens. I mean, with horses and after the race, is it how long is their career and what happens next?
Well, you know, there are some horses who get really lucky. The horses that I wouldn't say they get lucky, but the horses that are the really good performers live a life that you and I might be a little envious of. They really do get taken care of. But there are a lot of horses that as their careers wind down, they kind of go from famous track to less famous track to less famous track to less famous track until they're worth about $2,500. And those horses, unfortunately, a good sizable proportion of them do end up in slaughterhouses, not anymore in the United States.
Yeah, I was going to say there are no more slaughterhouses in the United States, which is a real problem for many reasons.
Yeah, it's a really weird subject. The thoroughbred industry has been better probably than other industries because they, as far as like trying to find homes for unwanted horses, which is probably the right term to use for it. So there have been a variety of programs that the thoroughbred industry has started up, but nowhere near as many. The problem with dealing with horses and end stage career problems and unwanted horses is that the horse industry is currently fractured. The thoroughbred industry has supported federal legislation, federal efforts to completely ban slaughter, while still not acknowledging the extent of the problem in their own industry, while still not throwing enough resources at it. But you do get up into a problem where the other elements of the horse industry, quarter horse industry, standard bred horses, pleasure horses, and the veterinary community believe that slaughter should be an option. They believe that slaughter should be a humane option. In other words, let's pass laws that make sure that the horses are treated well as they're transported to the slaughterhouse and are then slaughtered in a humane way. So you don't have any kind of consensus within the larger equine industry about how to address this problem. The thoroughbred industry, as I said, has not done enough to address it, but is actually making a lot of headway. I've been surprised, actually, in the last couple of years at the amount of at the effort that the industry has put forth to address this problem, which is a real problem. It is not in any way morally defensible to use these animals for the purposes that we do, and then not ensure that they have that they are allowed to live out their life in comfort once they're done.
And at the moment, they're being shipped to Mexico and Canada, where the slaughters are going on there.
Right, yeah, and I think the numbers, and I don't have it in front of me, but I think that they talk about maybe, in the 90,000 range a year. Not many of those are thoroughbreds. A lot of those are pleasure horses. And people do get I'm sure everyone knows a friend that had to give up a dog or a cat because they moved and relocated, or they could, in New York especially, my apartment doesn't take dogs or cats. People lose their jobs and horses are expensive. There are always going to be horses falling through the cracks, but you want to find, you want to make sure that those that do fall through the cracks, that can no longer be cared for by their owners, have a place to go to where you can rehabilitate them or find another family or person that can take care of that horse for the rest of
the time. I think thoroughbreds face a particularly difficult future in that sense, just because they are not pleasure horses. They are not pets.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a lot harder to convert a thoroughbred used to racing into an animal that is just a saddle horse. I mean,
you know, it's a lot easier to trade around a quarter horse than it is
these are
a very high strung, flighty animal with delicate bones and a real will of their own that are used to a totally different life than the normal household, you know, domestic animal.
Yeah, these are performance horses. They they can be turned into hunter jumpers, but hunter jumpers' careers come to an end too. They don't,
absolutely,
you know. They are, and like you said, these are flighty horses who have actually spent their career in conditions and in environments that are not actually conducive or are not what they would grow up in the environment. It is not right for the thoroughbreds to be in stalls 23 hours a day, for example. People are trying to adopt better training methods that gets them out of their stalls, you know, but a lot of horses are forced to live, a lot of thoroughbred horses are forced to live in conditions that are completely antithetical to what they evolved to
what we
to live
have
in.
Evolved them to live in. Also, I mean, as you said before, it's morally indefensible to.
Yeah. But those behaviors, you can't breed that out. You can't breed a horse that is going to be comfortable in a stall. You know, that's just impossible.
Right. Or that's going to be good for a small child to ride on.
Exactly.
Yeah. You can't turn them into a school horse at, you know, Smithbridge Farm in Wakefield, Rhode Island.
It's not an option, really. Matt, we really appreciate you coming in.
Yeah,
you
know, please come back, Matt.
You're just here for a few weeks, or actually a few days this weekend, covering Saratoga. And Matt, it's Matt Haggerty, and you can be read. For those who are reading the Daily Racing Forum, you know, if you want to read beyond the stats and the numbers, Matt's in there daily at any track, Saratoga, Aqueduct near us, and he's coming
Belmont.
To a track, Belmont, coming to
That's
a track near you.
That's a beautiful track.
Matt knows his stuff. He's only been doing it for 15 years, so he might know a little bit about the ponies. Matt, we really appreciate you being here. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much
Come
for
back
having
soon.
Me.
And the Q Report, just wanted to finish up. The music you've been hearing on our breaks is, of course, Les Paul, who passed away this week, which, of course, is weirdly ironic at the 40th anniversary of Woodstock. The man who invented the solid body electric guitar. That's all. I mean, you know, the Beatles,
just that.
Elvis, that's all. he also invented reverb and multi-track recording. That's all. He only reinvented the music we all listen to. This is listening to Ms. Ford, his wife, his longtime companion, and Les Paul. Thanks for the Q Report, Katie.
Thanks,
I'm Mark Marbella.
This is fun.
Katie Kiefer.
And thanks to all of our guests. Thank you to our engineer and our producer, Jack and Nat. And thank you very much to our sponsors, White Oak Pastures. Finally got it.
Yes.
And
we'll be back if it's Sunday. If it's Sunday, it's the Q Report, not Meet the Press. Thanks.
Adios, guys. I don't want to know how